Welcome to Drinks Insider, the podcast that's interested in everything you can drink. If it's legal, if you can sell it, and more importantly, if you can make money from it, then we're going to talk about it. So come on this journey into the commercial world of everything drinkable. I'm your host, Felicity Carter, and you're listening to Drinks Insider. Brace yourself. This episode has some of the most clear-eyed, data-grounded thinking about the structural crisis in the global wine trade that you are going to hear anywhere. And if you think your market is different, your region is special, or your loyal customers will see you through, my guest might make you think again. Professor Simona Luza holds the Chair in Business Economics of the Wine and Beverage Sector at Hochschule Geisenheim University in Germany, where she has led the Institute of Wine and Beverage Business Research since 2015. She's had an extraordinary career that spans a bank apprenticeship, a doctorate from Dresden on consumer behaviour in sparkling wine, senior research positions at the Uni of South Australia, a European Commission Marie Curie Fellowship, and more than 15 years as an adjunct senior research associate at the Ehrenberg Bass Institute for Marketing Science, which, if you know anything about how brands actually work, you will know is one of the most rigorous marketing science institutions on the planet. So what that means is that Simone does not deal in intuition. She deals in longitudinal financial data from wine estates, real-time sales streams, and 35 years of archived business performance data that exists nowhere else in the wine world. So if she tells you something is happening, it's already in the numbers. So she's based in Germany, and Germany is her primary case study. But the dynamics she is describing are not German problems. They are the wine industry's problems, playing out at different speeds in different markets. Australia is adjusting, California is adjusting, and France is still arguing about whether the word oversupply means anything. So here we go. Professor Simone Luce, thank you very much for joining me. And just to start, I would be interested in knowing how you became a wine economist.
Felicity, it's so great to join your podcast. It's a real honor for me. Actually, that's not a straight story how I became a wine economist. I was at a school specialized in science and math, and I was in a bordering school when the wall came down. And my main topic where I really fell in love with and where we were successful in competitions was biology. Okay. And if the wall hadn't come down, I might have become a biologist. And then basically, you know, 91, the East German economy broke down. And also my parents, who were really young, they had to do it, choose a different profession. And in East Germany, you grew up in a sense that you are responsible for yourself. So I knew and I learned, okay, if I'm becoming a biologist in West Germany, I will be unemployed. And this is the worst ever thing that you can imagine to happen. And this is what we learned in communism, I'm sorry, that every, you know, people are unemployed in West Germany. And so I said, I'm responsible for myself, so I do something with this which is safe. So I'm becoming a bank clerk. Which basically means, you know, going to bank where the money is, it's safe. And in Germany, you do apprenticeship for 2 years. And this is what I did. And of course, you know, I learned a lot, but also I learned this is not something for the rest of my life. But I stayed in this kind of rail. So I continued by studying international business because there was the first year, they hadn't sorted things out. So I switched after winter into business administration. So this is how I came on the business side. And then whenever I was on travel, my passion came back. So in 1993, I was visiting the Rhone Valley and I got infected by the wine virus. So basically, you know, I was seeing the fields. It's biology. In the cellar, you have physics and chemistry. And this is what I wanted. So I started to drink wine. I pulled off the labels, I did put them in a book, so I, you know, and I wrote some notes about it. And I wanted to know about the sensory world, how people taste it, and how this works with the brain and the tongue and the senses. And this was something I did on the side of my studies. And then I worked in summer at the Mosel Valley for a wine grower, and I tried to combine my passion with my business. And I visited Geisenheim for the very first time in 1999, it must have been, visiting the library, which is basically the Holy Grail, you know, Geisenheim, that's wow, you know, this is where the wine world is in Germany. And then I met my predecessor, Professor Hoffmann. He said, you know what, if you can do a bachelor, a PhD thesis in Dresden, I have a topic for you if you're interested. And that was about whether people care about where the origin of face wine and sparkling wine is. And so I did my PhD in Dresden, and the topic was from Geisenheim. And this kind of, you know, brought me, the two of them together. And that's basically, I can say I have so much enjoy of what I do now. I'm happy I didn't become a biologist and looking at the small glasses and, you know, treating the mice and doing whatever I want. So I love what I do. I'm at the right place in my life. And it's just great being here.
That's so interesting. You know, what you're giving is a sort of classic romantic wine history, going to the Rhone Valley and looking at the vines. And yet you are one of the most pragmatic people in the whole international world of wine. How do you manage those two sides of you?
Pragmatic in a sense, and I thought about it for quite a while, is I think one reason is I grew up in Eastern Europe, in East Germany, because I think Eastern Germany is part of Eastern Europe. Which basically meant we experienced a big change in our life already, which West Germany now starts to understand that things like this can ever happen. And I also, you know, when you're older than 50, you think about your own life. And I believe what really motivates me is to try to understand why things happen. In Germany, we have this famous writer, Goethe. I don't know if you know about Mephisto.
I know about, yes, of course.
So Faust sold his soul to Mephisto to learn about the world. I think that really resonates really strongly with me, is I get so much satisfaction out of understanding why things happen. And looking at history of mankind, looking off wine as a plant, looking at economics, I think these are the big drivers that will shape the future of wine and shaped it for centuries already.
So we're here to talk about wine and the wine market, but I'm fascinated. I was in Dresden and Leipzig just around New Year, and I went to the Goethe Cellars in Leipzig. But what was the culture shock like going from East Germany and having heard all these stories about, you know, the mass unemployment and so on in the West, to actually experiencing the West? What was that like?
I was young. Yeah. You know, if you're young, you can easily adapt. It's so easy. I was 16 when the wall came down. So it was just suddenly a door opened and you go through, and then that was easy. I mean, it was much harder for older people, and that's why you still have, you know, all the difficulties. But honestly, I was just the luck of being born late.
Yeah, I've got a friend here in where I live in Neustadt, who grew up in Dresden, and she said the big shock she got when she crossed into the West, and this was before the wall came down, was she said the amount of colour and the fact that there were so many restaurants from different cultures, she found that really wild, the level of colour in West Berlin, which I thought was interesting. But we are here to talk about wine. So the big question of the moment, and I know you're very precise and you want to give precise answers, and I'm asking you a general question, but wine seems to have been hit by everything on every front. We've got the cost of living crisis. We've got a demographic crisis, which is rolling. There's a cultural change, which I never thought that I would see in my lifetime, where people are beginning to see wine not as wine, but as a toxin. From your point of view, can you give me your overview of the market in terms of, are these short-term changes we're seeing, or are these long-term drivers that we're going to have to adapt to?
Firstly, these are really clearly structural changes we are going towards. And again, wine is for me one special product, but it's a product. And it's one industry like many others. And we see it's not the only industry that goes through these changes. So cost of living has hit many industries. Demographics, at one of the miners' conferences, I was saying a joke, at the North Sea in Germany, there are islands where on Friday you see who's coming for tea on Sunday. So wine is like that. Because we have the older generations, you know, we can actually observe the other industry, what's going on with the young people, and we could theoretically react to that. So demographics, all Eastern countries, mainly Germany, but also Italy, but also Great Britain, demographically, they are shrinking, particularly in the cultures that are European. Of course, we buffered by immigration, but the immigration was basically had a strong distance to alcohol in any case. Demographics in Europe, that is something you can watch, and we knew 20 years ahead that this is going to happen. You know, we live in the golden areas after the Second World War, where we had plenty of money. It was, if you look at the, you know, Maslow pyramid, in general, wine is a beverage. It's a beverage which is safe because it has alcohol in it. It's a beverage that has social functions. And on top of that, what we did is to have an aspirational utility. And this is only something you care for if you don't have to bother about other problems in your life, aspiration. So as soon as other things kick in again, and you have to worry about, okay, do I have enough money to fill my tank with €2.30 a liter diesel? You know, what about the energy, you know, in total? What about unemployment, the industrialization of Europe? You know, what about war? And what about, you know, the Gulf Stream collapsing in the future? So we come down the ladder towards more basic needs. And that's where I believe wine is fit more stronger than other goods. But if you look at the luxury watches, I just read an article about the Swiss watch industry on last weekend. They face exactly the same problem.
Yeah, I mean, but, you know, I think when I talk to people in wine, a lot of people in wine think that they've got magic protection from the cultural heritage. And, you know, people listening won't know this, but there was a famous article written last October in the Süddeutsche Zeitung where a writer actually said it would be a great thing if wineries began to close down because it means fewer deaths from people. Are you shocked by that? I mean, that isn't just a cost of living crisis now. That's a legitimacy crisis as well. Did you see that coming?
I didn't see it coming. And honestly, I don't believe it is affecting people so strongly. If that worked, no one would smoke and no one would eat sugar.
That's right.
I'm sorry. And that's not happening.
And we'd all go to the gym.
Yeah. Yes, but still, I mean, if you go to a swimming pool in summer and you see the obese kids, you really worry about the future. So I would say that, yes, it's about a big discussion about that alcohol is not one of the safest goods. But what I also believe, or the people I talk to, and it's also partly outside of the wine bubble because I have school kids, so I talk to other people, and they tell me, you know what? It's a stressful life. And when I drink in the evening in a week, then I'm not fit the next morning. So yeah. I don't feel perfectly well. So I can only drink on the weekends. And you know what? I'm now a bit older, so I can only drink a glass. And this is not, they don't tell me, my doctor told me I shouldn't. They start to listen to themselves. And what I believe is we are now in a stadium or in a position in our society where I believe 20 years ago, someone, and you said you wouldn't drink, you were odd, you were not normal, something was wrong with you. And now it's just normal if you don't drink, you're fine. We are not yet at the phase that you're odd when you drink.
Yeah,
that's not true. So I believe now, you know, historically, honestly, if you look back to Germany, 20 years, 30 years, when my brother was 16, being able to drink alcohol, there were scenes you didn't want to capture on your smartphone. So I'm glad this is over. So I believe the pendulum swings, and of course it won't stop at the optimal point. It swings further and then it will come back. But if you look at what is healthy, then it is Mediterranean diet.
Yeah.
And that is eating a lot of vegetable, seasoning it with olive oil, and when you eat, drink a glass of wine. That's perfect. But if you look at how people drink wine, it's more than that. Or if they how they drink alcohol.
Let's move to sort of more technical issues. Do you want to talk about the research that you're doing in the wine market at the moment? And then we can talk about some of the historical research that Geisenheim has done.
Absolutely. Well, one of the research we are doing is I perceive our institute as a kind of a thermometer or a measurement instrument of what's going on in the wine sector, to feed it back to the sector for them to be able to adjust and react. And we have two big measurements instruments. One is one I inherited from Professor Hoffmann and Dirk Haupt, which is basically the guys in business analysis, where over 35 years, we collected financial statements of the wine industries, and we basically track, today I can call it its financial sustainability or business sustainability.
What an astonishing archive. Is there anything comparable anywhere else in the world?
I don't think so for the wine sector. I mean, if you go to other industry, of course that exists. And there are circles where a couple of businesses come together to benchmark, and they even employ someone to do it for them. So in other sectors, that is absolutely normal. But in the wine sector, I don't know of any place that doing
so. You occupy a position of enormous trust then, that producers will give you that data. How do you convince them to hand it over?
Honestly, when I came in, I realized that we have this trust. Coming from a bank, I realized that. And why do we have it? We have it because we are the alma mater of the wine sector in Germany. If you talk to people, they tell, I'm a Geisenheim person. I did my education at Geisenheim. So I realized, wow, there is this huge trust. And I also told my people, we have to keep it like this. People have to be, in a safe and a steel thing. So no, we can never ever leak data. It's so important, because then it's dead. When I came in, we slowly started to build up surveys, and I got myself known to the industry. And then suddenly we had the idea for the second tool, which is even going a bit further, in a sense that we had these surveys, people telling me once a month, how their sales were and what the volume and value. And then I'm really interested in data and then in IT. And I said, we are playing a fun game here. They look in the digital system, then they enter what they see there in a form, and then I have to put it back in the digital system. So why can't I get a direct stream of information, why can't I get the data directly in detail from their ERP system? And I had some, mentors outside in the sector who brought this idea to me. But speaking to colleagues, they all said, you are crazy. They will never give it to you. This is something so stupid. You will not succeed. And again, it's about partners. So since 2017, we are partnering with one ERP system, Vinesto, or it was called
Can you explain what an ERP system is, Simone?
An ERP system is the digital thing where you write your invoices. You put in the name of the person. And in the wine sector, it is more than that, because you are obliged to have a track of what's going in your cellar. You need to be able to record how many bottles are in your cellars. So it's a whole suit for the whole chain.
Does this mean that you can see what's happening in the German sector almost in real time?
Yeah. Yes.
Goodness gracious. And you've been able to do that since 2017?
We started to build it up
2019.
And again, then it took quite some time before it was running. And knowing now what it takes, I'm not sure I would do it again, but that's always like that.
But you're glad you've done it, I guess.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'm not sure I would do it in another, on retail side, but we were lucky to have a partner who had 100 wine estates already ticking a box saying, your data can be given to Geisenheim for analysis. So we had a snowball to start with. I knew from my feeling that if we can give the industry something as an example, what they receive, if they give us their data, then we can build it up step by step.
And what do you give them? What do they get in return for this?
Reports. Well, no money, but they get once a month, they receive a report. This is going on in the industry. Once a quarter, they receive a report. This is what's going on in your business. And then we start, to roll out. So now we're having geographical analysis. Where are the wine consumers? We tell them how the different sales channels are going, because historically, we, of course, have data from Nielsen and IRI about the retail. But you know that wine is also the on-trade, especially wine shops and the direct-to-consumer sales. Mm. And for the very first time, someone in the wine sector can measure that.
So this is fascinating because, you know, it's always said about Germany that Germany is a low-cost wine market and, you know, the wine is underway. Because that's because of the measurement of supermarket wines. But it's never captured the premium segment or the cellar door segment very well. So what was the most surprising thing that you discovered when you started to collect that data?
In hindsight, I was realizing that the estimates from the producers were not really off of what we measured, because we measured in the surveys, oh, my average price is 5.00. And of course, you knew this is an estimate. But actually, the real average price direct to consumers per bottle is not that far away from 5.00. What I had expected that the on-trade might have been more important, but what we measure, sales from the producer directly to the guest on-trade, is only about 15% of the volume.
Oh, that's really surprising.
Yeah.
That's really surprising because that's always been considered the most high-value sector. So where is the value? Is it direct to consumer? Is it people selling at the cellar door?
It's 50% of the wine producers.
So on the one hand, I guess that's a good thing because you've got your own customers. And the other thing, it's a bad thing if your customers stop coming or if they get too old. Is that a problem?
It's a big problem. It's we can really see in life how consumers get less and less. We analyzed it between 21 and 25, it just sent it off to the wine estates 2 weeks ago, showing them per year, on average, you use 4.2% of your customers.
Wow. And is that pain shared equally, or are there some regions that are obviously shedding customers faster than others?
It is. There are differences, and there are several reasons for that. And one of the reasons is double geography, in a sense that big brands have more consumers who buy more often. And we have big brands, which in Germany is Peladenac, and also in Hesse, because they're just big. And then comes Mosel, and they've been more agile in going where the consumer is. Whilst if you are a small producing region like Saxony or Saale-Unstrut, you are living in an area where there's a lot of old people anyway, because young people like me left. There's not.
Yeah.
So they will see a decline of 25% reduction in population in these areas. And because they are so small and they're nowhere else, sold nowhere else, so they will lose dramatically.
So when you send out these reports, I mean, one of the interesting things was about 15 years ago, I read a Rabobank report of I think it was the French sector. And one of the things they said how many wineries didn't realize they were going broke because they were getting subsidies. You know, they weren't spending money on capital equipment, on replanting, but they still had money coming in and they didn't actually realize they were zombie businesses. Do you see something like that happening where people don't realize that they're actually no longer functioning as businesses?
I would say it's exactly the same. What we see is who participates in our analysis of the businesses? It's above interested, above business savvy industries or businesses. And that's basically, and already there, we only see about 50% can make a living out of their wine estate.
Wow.
And the rest, basically, they pay themselves very little money. Or they live off their investments in the past, which they will not be able to replace.
So, you know, there's that famous economic dictum, if something can't go on, it won't. Where is all of this heading?
I fully agree with you, because what I observe very often is that we, in the future, we say, oh, it's coming like this and that. No, it can't be, because it's too negative. It can't be like that. It'll be different. Well, where is this heading towards? It's we will see that a lot of the business will, I call it, run out. They won't be able to reinvest. What we also see is that some of them are just doing it for their hobby. They don't pay themselves any wage. And what this is why, since about 2 years, I tell the younger business owners, get out of the sector. Oh, earn money for your pension. Because this system worked until about 2022. It did work, because you could sell your land to a different business which wanted to grow. So it was a snowball system.
So I need to explain to listeners what we're talking about here is the German pension system, which you don't have to contribute to if you're self-employed. And so people didn't because they were expecting that they could sell their business at retirement. And this is now slammed into the wall. And there is potentially a wave of old age poverty about to hit the German wine sector. Have I said that correctly, Simone?
Absolutely. There is. They have to contribute a little bit, but if they receive this pension, this agricultural pension, it won't cover their living costs.
Right. So you're collecting information, you're not advocating, but when people get your business report, do they ring you up in panic and say, Professor Luce, what should I do? What do you do with, what happens to all this information? It's terrifying.
Actually, it starts to increase, but we can observe directly how many people look in the reports. And in their own business data, it's just a few percentage. They don't want to know it.
Really? So they're really sort of like, I can't deal with it. I'm just going to close my eyes and hope it works out for the best.
This is psychologically. Is if you know you can't change things and things are bad, do you want to know it?
Well, I'm a bit like that about a few things myself, actually. Just thinking about it.
This is how humans work. And that's why I don't blame them. It's just a normal thing that if that's why there is this framework of moderation of how can you make a change. Is the first thing is you're shocked by the news. And then after a while, you need to digest it. Then there is a window for opportunity where you might be able to change something. And not everyone can change things. Some of them are not able to. Some are not willing to. And for many changes, you need further investment. And where does this come from?
Yes, I'm already hearing from people in Australia that, you know, the difference with the new world and the old world really is debt. So in the new world, people tend to borrow money. And, you know, debt is a bad thing, but it also imposes a discipline where you have to be businesslike because you've got to pay that money back. So in some ways, it's not a bad thing, but the banks have stopped lending to the wine sector. I've heard that loud and clear.
That's absolutely true. I mean, we had a presentation from someone from a bank basically telling, we still lend if you have a good business plan. So you need to show us that you're earning money and that you will earn it, you know, to pay back your loan, because all the securities, the lend has no growth any longer. So they don't want to hand out money to then get your land and sell it to someone, because this is not their business.
Gosh, okay, so at this point you'd think the government would be interested if they're going to have rural regions that are going to depopulate or there's going to be a hole blasted through the economic centre of it. Well, what's the government response? I mean, I don't want you to answer for the government, but as somebody who knows about this, is there a government response to this?
Not as strong as we needed it. What I like about the new world is you are market-oriented. In California, there is a clear plan. So they know we have to reach equilibrium. There has to be a match between supply and demand. So that's forgiven. No one questions that. Whereas in the old world, everyone says, oh, I need to change, then the government should help me. You know, the government is responsible. It's not about me. So if I'm asking the industry and tell them you need to find an equilibrium, and if you lost 20% of the volume, then we need to give up 20% of the land. People don't want to hear that. They don't accept that. And I mean, you know, living in Germany, that wine is one of the problems, not the most important one at the moment. Yeah. You know, we have an infrastructure that's not working. We have no army. You know, we have no digitalization. So I guess you're not surprised to hear that the agricultural minister is not wanting to hand enough money to the sector, which I also hear, I don't know because I'm not grown here, I'm not born here, is in the past, obviously, the wine sector was the one earning most. And they seem to have been a bit snobbish compared to the other agricultural sector, which seems to work quite economically driven at the moment. But they say, you know what, guys, you are the small, so already told us that you are better, though now you feel you do, you're not better.
Actually, this is true. So again, for anyone listening, I live in a small country town. It is a wine town. And I've actually talked to my friends about the crisis in the sector, and they literally don't believe me. People sit at the coffee morning and they go, no, the wine growers are the people who have the money. And if you walk around this region, there are very big properties that were earned a lot. And so, you know, you see people who live in these sort of semi-castles and everybody's going, no, it's not a problem. I go, it is a problem, guys. But I think maybe the visual spectacle of the sandstone castles is part of the problem. People just look at it and go, how can they be in trouble? But they are.
Yeah. I mean, in Germany, you have a lot of castles coming from areas where people earn money and something else. And now this changed, and wine needs to change.
All right, so this is we've done the bleak and depressing things. Who is doing well in this circumstance? When you look at all of these figures, which businesses are doing well and why?
It's actually not that easy to find a lot of companies who grow. And one reason is, of course, because of this high sunk cost. You know, right. a grape stands there for 50 years. So you don't just stop and go out of the business. That's why we have the oversupply dumps the prices. So at the moment, even those businesses who should live, who should survive, they struggle because the prices are so low. So the first thing is to clear the market. That's the most important.
Okay. That's going to be painful, but it needs to be done.
We see some who have been thinking really entrepreneurial, who didn't come up with the old mindset, but I know a couple of businesses where I realized, well, they might have been either established, you know, about 20 years ago when there was the golden era in Germany for wine, because everyone discovered German wine can be good. And they have always made their own thing very customer-oriented, building a brand, telling a story, not necessarily about terroir, maybe something else. And we also observe a second group is actually a group that was in trouble 10 years ago.
Okay, interesting.
Who had to change, who came into this direction, I need to look what I can improve. I need to get in this idea of looking left and right and being able.
I know Germany being Germany that I can't ask you for names, but can you think of somebody in your head that was in trouble who turned it round and talk about what they did?
Actually, they, again, still in the good time before the crisis, 22, you know, because afterwards it got really hard. What they did is look in their books, understand their costing, how much can I spend?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there's always the costing side. And the rest, honestly, is about the marketing side. And I always say, I take for granted that you have a good product because very few have.
Yeah.
Very few don't have a good product. So, of course, you can improve your product, but that's not the number one leverage.
No.
The leverage lies in, I know one of the wine estates having 30,000 consumers in their database. So sending out one email every 2 weeks means you get a good activation. They also understood that regionally in the area around them, they have to find partners where they have touch points to reach other people in an emotional setting, like teaming up with a football club and,
right.
You know, serving the wine in one of their premier clubs. Getting to know locally and what I also understand is this whole event thing, getting people to my area, you know, being a nice host, not telling about the problems, entertain and collect their addresses so I can reach them afterwards again. Having a very good system of B2B sales, talking to my, you know, specialty retailers. How much can you do of this and that? What kind of classification do you need from this? You know, so starting to treat them not as just dumping your products, but as a partner. So this is just something that comes off my mind, is really understanding the mechanics of sales and business administration and playing that in the good times. So it's running when the times get worse.
So this comes to a really structural question about the lack of business knowledge in the wine trade. Some of it is the fact that it's too family oriented. And you know, one of the things is everyone talks about how great family businesses are, but having seen some of them up close, they can be just as dysfunctional as anybody's family, where, you know, that you can't bring in expertise because dad wouldn't like it, you know, because you show him up. But, you know, one of the problems, of course, is that it's very hard to get expertise overseas because wineries can't pay the salaries, and also because it's rural and people who are, you know, very expert at what they want to do want to go and work in Berlin or Hamburg where they can, you know, have more career opportunity. And the other problem I see is that I see many wine schools that are offering sort of business courses that aren't really business courses. I've looked at so many wine MBAs, which are not MBAs in any sense at all. They're not they're not teaching finance, logistics, or accounting, and it seems to me that there's an almost institutional denial in wine of the need to have those skills. The most abuse I've ever had in my life was when I wrote a piece called How to Make Money in Wine, and people clicked on it and it said learn to use spreadsheets, and I got loads of abuse because people thought I was saying make wine by recipe, and I wasn't. I was saying learn your cost of goods sold. Anyway, so this is a long-winded rant on my part, but how do you think the wine trade could or should solve that shortage of business acumen?
It's not easy to do so because, you know, we now do our best in Iceland to teach the young students, and there's still room for improvement. We just have been, redoing the schedule for our enology program, and you can't imagine the fight we have to do against our science colleagues who still believe knowing chemistry and microbiology and the soil, you know, it's the most important thing to sell the wine. So we are a few business people arguing against the long row of scientists. And because, you know, my background in science, so I understand them, but they never had to sell wine. And they still don't fully accept of what's coming in the wine sector. We have some big supporters who you know, tell us, you know, the wine, the enology programs, they need to be entrepreneurial.
Yeah.
And how will it solve? Well, this is also something I thought about for a long time is, and going back into mankind's history will help us with that. Because we always believe there is a person and an industry changes by this person itself changing and learning. That's not true. If you go back into Europe's history, do you know where agriculture came from? By the people from Turkey or Anatolia bringing this method to the north. And basically, you know, getting the other people out. So it's about new businesses doing better, getting market share, and the other businesses dying.
Well, don't they say science precedes one funeral at a time? Maybe that's it. Well, you know, as you're speaking, of course, there are models for success. And one of them at the moment is, you know, new software systems that are highly responsive to sales if you've got the emails on your thing. You know, there's new software systems that will allow you to see that somebody's about to drop out as a customer that you can, you know, you offer them. How much of those have been taken up inside Germany, and what would it take for them to be widespread?
We are working closely with one of the software providers, and they had a program taking four businesses on board on their hands and trying to teach them how to use the software and how to improve. And what I heard in a personal discussion is one of the owners telling me, you know what, we tell them, we show them, but for them it's so hard to put it in their daily routine.
Right.
Because they are overloaded, burdened by so much stuff they have to do.
I have a lot of sympathy for this. I mean, I find handling receipts really difficult. Should just scan them and then be done, but yes. It doesn't happen.
Excellent. The same for me. I always say, why don't I do better?
But, you know, one thing that has happened in the last, you know, certainly in the time that I've been around, which is 25 years now, I've been 18 of that in Germany, things have changed enormously. And one thing about the world of wine is that there's an enormous international exchange. Do you see that, you know, how do you see that operating? Do you think people are affecting? Do you think that, let me rephrase that. Do you think we're getting to a point where people are sharing information more openly and actively looking for partnerships and looking for solutions now than in the past?
We already could observe it in the enology part, because actually the German enology benefits strongly by international exchange, by students going out. Well, I believe on the business side, there are a few frictions and barriers to this exchange. And one of that is different regulations, different rules, language barriers, because the software in France is still running in French. And if I talk to my colleagues in Italy or France, I don't hear some saying, you know, this, you know what, just go there. And they know, they tell you. I would say the best place to go is possibly larger companies in Italy. I think they're quite professional. But again, you know, how easy is it to transfer that knowledge to a small company in Germany where you don't have this strong specialization? By the way, this is something we observed, is who was able to continue improvement after the financial crisis 2008.
That is very interesting. Who was able to continue?
The larger companies who were specialized. Who, not the small family businesses, but those who had a couple of employees. So there was one for the seller, one for the viticulture part, and there was actually a person who could concentrate on the business and the sales.
Right.
And I mean, honestly, is that a surprise if you go back to economic history? Our welfare comes from people getting better in doing one thing and then specializing.
Okay, so a key weakness of the family model is people doing too many things.
This is a weakness, absolutely. At the same time, what we also see at the moment is those very big companies, owned by states, by local states. We have many of them in Germany, which basically said, you know, all the collected vineyards, we put them into one wine estate, and this is our state estate. And if they have three tiers, like a CEO, a middle tier, and workers, they are so much affected by increasing wages, you have no idea. Because the...
Also, it's the on-trade. That's a problem of the on-trade internationally, actually.
I just talked to one of the states 2 days ago, and they told me, in the old days, we would do the correlation, who is doing what at lunchtime overeating, or we would do it for dinner. So we didn't have to have work meetings where we had to pay people, because it was part of our spare time. And just now, coordinating employees who work for 40 hours a week, this is difficult.
All right, so let's assume that thanks to the German lower tax base, Geisenheim has just lost all of its funding and you are now unemployed finally, as you once feared, Simone. You've become a consultant to the wine sector. With all of your knowledge, if I'm a little family-owned business in Neustadt and I come to you and I go, what can I do? How would you turn me around?
I would look at your sales data. I would look if you have your people on your ERP systems or you can contact them. I would look at where you sell and how these different things changed over the last time and where there is room to improve. This would be the first thing. Then I would look at where, you know, benchmarks, where is there room for you to grow on the sales side? And only then I would go on the cost side and look, you know, where can we save money? Where can we maybe do less quality? I'm sorry to say that, because we see businesses who for the base level wine do so much hand labor that it's too costly.
That is such an interesting point. I was at a conference in, I think it was Australia, actually came up the question of, you know, should we worry about less quality for the lower tiers of wine? And people were horrified by the question. And it is, in some ways, it is a sort of horrifying question. But you're saying it's a really important question.
Because the lower, I mean... If you are in the cars industry, you can't sell an entry point car at the same luxury level as the top tier. It's not possible. It doesn't, you know, cost doesn't match the what you take in. So it's just natural that there has to be a differentiation. And I don't say that the base level is of poor quality.
Yeah.
It tastes, but you maybe it's not, doesn't have as much minerality. Maybe it's, you know, a bit lighter, a bit softer, maybe easier to drink, but actually that's what you would expect of an entry point wine. And that's where I see, you know, a new shift from a crisis always brings in a reaction. The last crisis we had in Germany was the glucose scandal in the 80s, which was about adding something to your wine which was not supposed to be there. So it was about quality.
And we have to be clear, this was not a German scandal, it was an Austrian scandal.
Yeah, but you imported it not obliging to the rules by mixing Austrian wine with German wine and selling it as German wine.
I I didn't know about that. That's something I didn't know about. Okay.
Because how could the Kleiger have come to German wine then?
Well, I knew it was in Austrian wine being sold, but I didn't realize it was. Okay, that's interesting. Okay, so this crisis, what happened next?
Well, of course, then people looked at quality. Absolutely, that would be the natural reaction. And they improved the quality, so we have now an international reputation. But what they didn't realize that latest by 2008, and with the increasing wages, they should have also looked at the costing. And like you do with your children, you can tell your child, but it only hears or listens when it first time burns the hand at the odd oven.
Well, there's actually a name for this. It's called Baumol's paradox, which is that your costs keep going up, but they talk about in terms of orchestras. It costs you more and more and more to hire musicians, but you can't get any added benefit from paying Beethoven twice as fast. the product is what it is. There's no optimization possible. And this is what's actually killing some of the cultural sector at the moment. So is there a way out of this paradox? So first of all, you're saying maybe do less work, like no hand pruning and whatever at the lower levels. What other possible ways out of this trap are there?
Honestly, I'm sorry for this bad news is for many businesses, there is no way out of the trap because maybe you have no customers or your customers are dying anyway. And to look for new customers, you are not the only one looking for new customers at the moment. If you are a business that, has a lot of things to repair and old stuff in your cellar, then there is no sense in investing in it. So if you're not, a lot of businesses can't be saved. You need to have a minimum level for you to be able to do so. Or ideally, we have a lot of businesses where the owner has its other food in a different business and cash could flow into wine. So that would help if you could invest.
Okay, so you're also not just in Germany. You know what's going on in the rest of the world. When you look at the international wine sector, what do you see?
I see a couple of countries who realize very clearly what's going on. California does, Australia does. And for them, they are already in the middle of adaptation and it hurts and it's bleeding and they grab up and they adapt their acreage. And we see, companies who rationally could see it very early on, like Treasury Wine Estates selling up very early on. So adapting. And I see in the old world, particularly in France, one of my colleagues in Bordeaux, Jean-Marie Cadebat, he coined the name of underconsumption. He says there is no oversupply, there's just underconsumption. So help us to do with that, which doesn't exist in economic theory.
Well, that's like when you go to a restaurant and you drink too much, that it's because you were overserved.
So I see that a couple of countries adapt, and for a couple, it will take much more time.
So it's very interesting. I mean, I don't want you to answer for markets that you don't know about, but I'm just interested in when I talk to people, most industries over the last 30 or 40 years have gone through downturns and contractions and so on. And the wine industry hasn't really. I mean, there was the global crisis where people traded down, but there hasn't been a sharp shock of the type that we're experiencing now. And part of it when I talk to people is I think maybe it's just there's no institutional memory of what a downturn is like. Just people are too used to everything growing. And where I see this particularly, and apologies to New Zealanders who are listening who I know their names, is that I really see this in New Zealand because New Zealand has had nothing but sunlight and sales that increase year on year. And they've had their first sort of minor sales drop and they're all panicking about it. How much of it do you think is that people don't have the resilience that comes from industries that go through contractions and expansions?
100% I agree. A quote comes to my mind from Steve Charters, who is a master of wine, who I really admire. We've been knowing each other for 20 years now. He's a professor at the Burgundy Business School. And just a few weeks ago, he told me, in the history, there was a 10-year long time span people accepted. So if something was older than 10 years, it had been there forever. And there couldn't be a change to that. And for the sector, for the wine sector, it's similar. And for Germany, it's very similar. So exactly, they haven't seen a change. Germany has now 100,000 hectares, and we drink about 23 million hectoliters. After the Second World War, we had 5 million hectoliters. People forget about it, that it hasn't been like this forever. And they now request for this to stay like this. So I fully agree that for the wine sector and for the older countries in Europe, we should look back and understand what drives change, and not being business-oriented makes it even harder.
Yeah, I will say, when we're talking about quality and not really talking about it, but one thing that strikes me is the quality of German wines is absolutely sensational for the price-quality ratio in international terms. You know, and I'm not just talking about Riesling, the Pinot Noirs are astonishing quality for the money, and I think they're underpriced in the world market. What do you think? Do you think there's opportunities there?
There are definitely opportunities. I mean, the world moves towards white wine. We have white wine. The world moves towards lighter wines. We have that. The world realizes, well, Burgundy Pinot Noir is too expensive, so well, just come to Germany. We are struggling a bit with two things. One is we have small businesses who need to invest. You know, you need to invest for 3 years before you sell something overseas. And you need to be able to do so. You need to be business-oriented, you need to be export-oriented. Which agricultural company is able to do that? And the second thing is, of course, what is Germany famous for internationally? Beer, sauerkraut, and machines.
Yeah. And it's like somebody once said to me, the problem with selling German sparkling wine is nobody wants the German lifestyle. They want the Italian lifestyle.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, this is so strong. I mean, you know, all this halo effect of the culture and the image, that's difficult for Germany still.
Well, okay, now this is a tactless question, so I'm going to phrase it very, very carefully. But if we look over the border at Austria, Austria faced a big wine scandal. They have lots of small producers. Viticulture is difficult. They have lots of family wineries. But one thing they have had in the last 20 or so years is they've had incredibly strong leadership. How much do you think leadership of the sector is important in a wine area?
It is very important. I can see that leadership was one reason for Austria's success. The second success is, again, they had this, the crisis in the 80s was stronger than for Germany, so they had to start from zero. The third advantage they have is they had a strong domestic base, so few people in Austria would actually not drink Austrian wines, which is very different in Germany. If Germany would just be Rhine on Palatinate and Baden-Württemberg, we wouldn't need to worry. But Germany is a lot more also beer culture. Coming back to leadership. Leadership is expensive, so you need to afford it.
Right.
What I see in Germany is we have these associations, and who is running it? Basically, former owners of wine estates who could hand over the business to their sons and daughters so they now have time. They are 60, 70 years old. So they have experience, but they're coming from a different frame. They're not flexible anymore, and they are kind of working for Bono.
Mm.
And I work with these guys, and I feel for them because I can't tell them you're lazy. They just can't do much more.
You know, you can't say lazy. You can just say, look, you're old and past your time, mate. No, you can't say that.
No, I can't.
No. I'm. It's a bad joke. All right, so final question. I mean, this is a crisis. It's not a sharp shock the way the crisis of glycol was, or the crisis of methanol poisoning in Italy was. But it is a nasty shock. If you look 10 or 15 or 20 years ahead, even though nobody can predict the future, Where do you see the wine sector, in as much as we understand you can't predict the future, in general terms?
To answer your questions, I need to understand, you know, what are the effects, the driving big factors, you know, shaping the wine sector. And this is one thing, it's demand. And we've been lucky to sell our Western lifestyle image to Asia and also to the US in the 2000s, drinking wine, which is that a model for the future? No. Demand in Europe we are becoming the museum of the world. So our population is becoming older and smaller. That basically means demand will decline. I don't see at the moment any factor globally where demand will rise sharply. Yes, it does a bit in Brazil. It might a bit in India. But I mean, you're coming from a Commonwealth country, so you know that they're spirits oriented and then they might be served by Australia first. What I also believe is, you know, we are living in this VUCA world. What we haven't talked about yet, but in the long term, it's having a big effect, climate change.
The what world?
VUCA. V-U-C-A. Volatility, uncertainty, complexity, ambiguity.
I didn't know that. I've learned something brand new. It is indeed that world, yes.
Yeah. So, I mean, just 2 days ago, I was reading that the Gulf Stream might collapse. Very likely. You know, the Gulf Stream is heating up Europe. So without the Gulf Stream, we are Canada. So what does it mean for wine? At the moment, we, of course, are very much concerned about Germany being, you know, drought resistant. It's becoming hot. But, I mean, where are we heading towards? And what does climate change mean for wine production? It means more uncertainty, more expensive, less predictive harvests. You need to earn money as an industry to be able to adapt and to be able to serve for the future. If you're not, supply will decrease, very logically. Of course, there might be wines for a while in Denmark and Sweden, a little bit, but it's not the same like Bordeaux. So supply will be more difficult and demand will shrink. At the same time, what I believe, looking in the world globally, is just look at the energy crisis at the moment. Personally, I believe more and more countries, particularly in Europe, are realizing that, you know, the fancy old times are over. The golden times are over. So this kind of ambitious consumption in the sense of, I'm drinking only my Bordeaux, or I'm drinking my super premium wines as a kind of definition of who I am, the Veblen effect. I believe people are increasingly getting other problems. And that's why I believe that there are less people globally. There will be still some who drink these high premium wines. I love your sentences that I read yesterday. We run the premium wagon as long as we could, and now it's time to jump on the affordability train.
Yeah.
That's what it is about at the moment. So it's back to the basic utility of wine. It's a beverage, and it's something for social occasions. But I don't have an Hermes handbag, and that's why I will not have a super premium Tuscany wine. Less people will have so. And that's why I believe this kind of adjustment of the sector will take 20, 30 years.
All right. Well, on that note, I will say thank you very much for your time, Simone. It's always a pleasure talking to you, and it's quite bracing. And I've learned VUCA.
Thank you so much, Felicity. It was great talking to you.
You've been listening to Drinks Insider, the podcast that explores the intersection of beverages and commerce. Now, if you would like a summary of this episode, sign up for the Drinks Insider newsletter, which sends you the takeaways. Just go to drinksinsider.com and add your name. And if there's something you think we should be talking about, drop me a line at felicity@drinksinsider.com. And before you go, please don't forget to rate this podcast. 5 stars are most welcome. Thank you.